This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
I lived in China for about a decade, in the late 90s to 2008. And while I was there, I became very interested in what China was doing in Africa. I took several trips there and was photographing there, and also slowly became aware that there was an African population in southern China, in Guangzhou. So I was working as a filmmaker and photographer in China, and kind of mostly documentary photography. And I started to go to Guangzhou with the intention of just kind of exploring this neighborhood where that was. You know, there were Africans there, but also Middle Easterners and people from South Asia. And I just kind of wanted to look at the spaces here and there, and how these foreigners were kind of impacting the neighborhood in this particular part of Guangzhou. And at first, I was looking at it more as kind of a straightforward documentary project, looking at the urban landscape and starting to make some portraits of interactions between the different people that were there. And I found I was kind of bored with the pictures I was making, because I felt like I'd seen similar pictures before, and they weren't really getting to what I wanted to what I was experiencing about the place. And there was one, this neighborhood in Guangzhou is very dense. It's kind of like this, have you seen in my pictures? They're kind of like these medieval warrens, these alleyways, and they're filled with people. And they're full of restaurants, and it has this kind of very loud, intense quality. And there's a pedestrian bridge that connects two parts of this neighborhood. The neighborhood is actually in the heart of Guangzhou, but there's a huge ring road that runs through the neighborhood. And then there's this pedestrian bridge that crosses over this ring road. And so I think, not really even thinking about it, I kept, just by needing a break from this chaotic, crazy neighborhood, I just kept going to this bridge, because it was just a place where you could kind of get a breath of fresh air, not really fresh air, but seemingly, you know, a place where you see the breath of the buildings in the distance, and just a sense of space. And so I started just going there and photographing, you know, people that were on this bridge. And after going there for a couple times, I started to notice these two photographers. Actually, first this one photographer who was photographing there, and he was interacting mostly with the Africans. Like, he would just be sitting on one side of the bridge, waiting for the customers to pass by, and he was holding this sort of placard with portraits on it. And then he would sort of sidle up beside passersby and kind of try to cajole them into having their picture taken. So I just observed him for a while, and then realized that what he was doing. And he was photographing, you know, mostly Africans, but also some Chinese, some Middle Easterners. And these were all people that were kind of visiting the neighborhood. And I realized that, so I went up to him and asked him if I could take a look at his pictures. And he allowed me to kind of go through the pictures that he was taking. And I found them, at first they were kind of repetitive. Like, they were, you know, everybody was doing the same poses. But then I started to see some of them were quite extraordinary. There was something very intimate about them and very playful. So I kind of befriended him, and then asked him at the end of this particular visit if I could start to collect his pictures. And I realized that if I was going to do a project about this neighborhood, that in a way his photographs could be a good complement to my photographs. So that's kind of how it all started.
could I ask you to talk a little bit more about this bridge? I mean, one of the the bridge is kind of a trope. It's a theme. It's both literally a bridge, a pedestrian bridge, but it's also a metaphor for so many things in this project.
Right.
So could you unpack for us what exactly this bridge is?
So as I kept going, let me just give a little bit more background. I over the next 7 years, I went from, you know, this project started in 2009 and then just ended, you know, it's still going on, but I stopped going there to collect pictures in 2014. So that's over a period of about six or seven years. And at first, my idea of the bridge was, you know, I didn't really have an idea of it, really. It was just this place where, for me, it was kind of a break from the intensity of documenting and walking around these other places. But slowly, my relationship with this one photographer grew. I went back maybe twice a year for several years, and then a couple years even more times. And then, so I got to know this one, the first photographer, Wu Yongfu, quite well. And then later I met another photographer, Zhen Xianfeng. And I also started to collect his photographs as well. So, and they both work specifically on the bridge. They were both photographers that were working in other parts of Guangzhou, mostly photographing Chinese photographers at tourist sites. And then Wu Yongfu was the first one, and he sort of realized that the Africans that he was encountering in other parts of the city seemed to want to have their picture taken more than the Chinese. So he realized that, well, he should go to this neighborhood where most of the African people were and kind of set up shop somewhere there. And he had the realization that this bridge is kind of like this, on the one hand, it's this... you know, mode of transportation that everybody in the neighborhood passes through it a couple times a day. So in a way, he was sort of setting up this photo booth that, you know, everybody needs to cross in front of. So my sense was that, in a way, the sense that the bridge is sort of lifted out of the neighborhood, it almost becomes this kind of stage. It has this... it's kind of like this platform that people are kind of brought outside of their usual daily life for a moment. So I think people stop to kind of reflect on their life and have their picture taken. So some of the photographs have this very theatrical quality, I found. Mm. Other times people are just taking a picture to kind of record a souvenir that they're going to take back to Africa or to send to relatives.
But for you in this project, the bridge is also a bridge that is a metaphor for those from the global south entering into contemporary mainland China. So could you talk more about also that?
Yeah. I mean, as the project developed, I started to kind of see the bridge as more of a symbolic structure, because it's on the one hand, it's something that's people that are passing, but also if you look at the index of people that pass through the bridge, you know, there's the Africans, there's Middle Easterners. It's really kind of a cross section of the people that are coming into China at this moment and into Guangzhou particularly. So you can kind of see it as this, I started to see it as this entryway or this kind of bridge that comes from Africa and the global south entering into China. That's one way to look at it.
But it's also a mechanism for making legible what you refer to in the project as those that have a precarious foothold in China as well.
So part of what has been interesting about the project is that this African population, particularly, let me back up a little bit. What initially drew me to the project was the African population, but once I got there, I realized that there's actually many other ethnicities that are there. There's Middle Easterners, Uyghurs from Xinjiang province in China, and also the whole neighborhood is full of migrants from other parts of China, and also there's a lot of South Asians. What initially I thought I was going to work on was just the Africans, but I started also kind of photographing all these other groups, and I lost my train of thought. But I guess I decided to focus on the African population specifically because they're kind of the newest group of people that have come to China. All these other groups have had longer relationships with China and have been there, whereas the relationship with Africa is something quite new. That's only been the last 20 years or 30 years. So in a way, it's a way of documenting. Collecting the photographs of these two photographers was a way of documenting these populations that are just passing through China, in a sense. And also the African population, because it's something quite new and in a way hasn't developed a kind of foothold in China in the way that the Middle Easterners and South Asians and Chinese migrants have been there for much longer. It was a way to kind of show this whole population that may not stay there that much longer. It's kind of unclear how connected they are really with China. So, and also they've kind of been, since the Ebola crisis, the Chinese government has kind of pushed them back a little bit. When visas expires, they're kind of asked to leave China. So it's the archive, in a way, is documenting something that may not last forever.
Yeah. Another topic that we spent some time talking about is how to contextualize this project within the broader history of visual culture, particularly how people represent other groups or indigenous communities or visually representing people from other parts of the world. And one thing we were talking about is the ethics of that type of representation. And in particular, we talked about two different projects that reminded me, and I think Aaron and Daniel, there were some similarities with this project. One project we talked about is the Taliban art book. I don't know how many people are familiar with that, because my area of research is Central and South Asia, and that was a situation where you had two white journalists who went into the south of Afghanistan and stumbled upon this archive of the Taliban, where they were taking photographs of themselves in these private photo booths that were not meant to be circulated. And it also was a commentary on some of the homosexual culture that is acceptable but in the private sphere within Afghanistan. And so they turned that into a very popular art book / coffee table book that circulated around the world without, you know, their consent or their acknowledgement. And so one of the things we talked about is that this is not the case with this particular project, because in many ways, and Daniel, I want you to talk more about this, is that they're presenting themselves, and this was staged in the public to begin with, and that this is actually more similar to a very famous ethnographic film from the 1970s by David McDougall called Photowallahs. I don't know how many of you are familiar with that one, but that was in the foothills of the Himalayas, and you have many different ethnic groups. And as Daniela was saying earlier, there's such a long history for centuries of what we call globalization today between all these different ethnic groups and races coming together. So it's not a new phenomenon. But this particular film, Photowallahs, looks at all the different groups in the region. Like people come to the Photowallahs or the photographer, similar to in this case where it's an economic transaction, and they dress in different costumes. They have an option of dressing like Nepalese or like Pashtuns or Pathans or Kashmiris, and then they take pictures of themselves. And that circulated very widely, but that was something that was publicly staged. And so we were talking about, especially in the digital age, what is the ethics of consent and how things circulate and contextualizing this particular work within that. So maybe Daniel, if you could talk a little bit more about the complexities of that.
I mean, the ethics of the project, I was aware from the beginning, were problematic because, I mean, these photographs were made by Chinese photographers that are there to making, you know, migrant workers, basically, who are trying to make a living doing this photo business. And then their customers are people who, they think that they're commissioning a photograph for their own use. And it was their assumption that the photograph, after it was printed out, would be deleted by the photographers. And that was the case with one of the photographers. He was he would delete the card, his memory card, after the end of every day. And then it was only after I gave him a hard drive did he start preserving his pictures. So it's you know, it's complicated because, you know, in a way, I don't have the consent of the people that were photographed, but I chose to collect these pictures regardless because I felt that something what was being shown, you know, this as a whole, this archive was something that was important to preserve, and particularly because it was unclear that these people would remain in China. It's kind of a document of a particular moment in China that may or may not last. And the fact is, both of the photographers have stopped photographing. So in a way, in the population, the African population in China is declining. So it is, in a sense, a kind of a moment that has passed already. So, you know, the ethics for me were, you know, whether I could have not collected these pictures, then we wouldn't have any of these pictures, and that would have seemed like a loss, or to kind of engage in something that's problematic in some ways, but figure out a way to do it ethically or sensitively. And there are other issues that, in the editing of the whole project and which pictures to present, I made certain choices, for instance. There are, I should say, like the people that were photographed are mostly traders that were coming from Africa to buy Chinese goods. But there's also a whole population of people who live in Guangzhou more permanently, maybe 100,000 or 200,000 people, who kind of serve as middlemen or set up shops to give service to the people that are visiting. And these people also had their photographs taken, maybe at the beginning when they first came. So there was, it's kind of a mix of different people. And some of there were also quite a lot of prostitutes that were, that had their photographs taken. Actually, some of their pictures are the most interesting because they have a kind of very performative and theatrical quality. But a lot of those pictures I decided not to include in the exhibition because some people made the argument that people in Africa don't know that they're working as prostitutes in China. So in a way, you're kind of, I would be exposing them. So that's one aspect that I've kind of negotiated. I tried to find a way to deal with. I think for a lot of archives, like there's many precedents for this kind of found archives of images, but one issue is that they're often images that happened 50 years ago or 100 years ago even. I think why this archive is more problematic is it's something that just happened a few years ago. You know, the people that are potentially still in China, and I think it would be less of an issue if it was a long time ago.
Yeah. I mean, just for the record, I don't think it's problematic. I think it's more in the realm of photo wallahs, which is when you're publicly right. presenting yourself, even if you don't have written consent, it's very different versus something that happens in the private that is not intended to. I mean, similar to what we were talking about with, you know, Instagram or Facebook or these types of things, once it's out there, you don't necessarily have, you know.
I think it's more problematic because it wasn't their assumption that these pictures were going to be used.
No, but, it's true.
I mean, but on the other hand, the Chinese photographers are, you know, they're collaborators with me. You know, they also are aware that this is going to be a book, that the pictures are being exhibited. So I think as photographers, they also have a right to show their work, you know, to kind of use their work for other purposes. Mm-hmm. So I think in that sense, and technically they own the copyright to the pictures too. So it's complicated.
It's hard not to see these portraits in relation to kind of an era, as Lajma was saying, of social media, kind of self-portraiture. Uh-huh. Can you take us through kind of the tensions or the relationship here between the personal and the public, between kind of the intimate, this seems to be an incredibly intimate archive, right? A 20,000 kind of size archive of intimacy, but at the same time they're staging themselves
kind of
in dialogue with the photographer and in public on this pedestrian bridge. So there's this really interesting interplay between the intimate and the public, between the personal and the public. So could you also talk a little bit about that?
Well, one thing, when I first met the first photographer, Wu Yongfu, the first guy that I met, when I was looking through, you know, I was just holding his camera and looking through them, and I was reminded of Malik Sadabe and Seydou Keita, which are two African, Malian photographers who had studio practices in the 50s and 60s in Mali. And a lot of the gestures and sort of poses and clothing seemed very familiar. And so that was kind of like the first thing that made me just connect with the pictures. Like, they seemed like something that I'd seen before. And I, you know, it's kind of unclear. It gets complicated because, in a way, these pictures feel like the customers are kind of carrying over these African traditions of portraiture. You know, in a way, they're telling the Chinese photographers how they want to be represented, how they want to be posed. So there's that aspect that, in a way, they're self-portraits. But then there's a question like, why? So how come, you know, most of these people have cell phones? So how come they're not just taking selfies? So there is something to hiring somebody else to make a portrait of you. So there's a kind of interaction between the Chinese photographer and the customer, which I think comes out in some, I think the Chinese photographer is more just a vehicle for them to make kind of an elaborate selfie or a self-portrait. But in other pictures, I think the Chinese photographer's personality comes out even more. Originally, when I was working on the project, I didn't separate the photographs of the two photographers. I kind of brought them all together into one, because I actually didn't, I wasn't really thinking about, I just assumed that all the pictures were kind of identical. But then I started working with another editor, Robert Pledge, in editing all these pictures, and he started to identify kind of differences between the two photographers, Wu Yongfu and Zhen Chunfeng. That in fact you can see differences in how they were approaching the subjects. Wu is in the first room. He tends to be much more formal and kind of stiff, kind of in a way more elegant, because he's kind of takes a certain distance from the subjects. Zen is much more kind of aggressive and kind of like tries to get gestures and. So in a way, you feel Zen's personality more in these pictures.
Can you also tell us a little bit about the complicated role of portraiture in relation to colonialism? And
yeah, I mean, this is something I'm not that familiar with, but I've learned a bit about it. Apparently, during French colonialism in West Africa, portraiture was a way for people, for the French to keep track of people, or it was a way of ordering kind of the different people there. But I think it became subverted by the Africans, and they kind of developed their own ways of using photography. And Malik Sadabe and Seydou Keita were people who kind of developed the tradition further. And so I think you know, the people here are really the inheritors of their work. They may not even know of those two photographers, but somehow it still comes across in the gestures. And also, like, you know, one thing I did was in this project I focused on the Africans, but actually, if you look at the archive, maybe 80% of the photographs in the archive of 30,000 images are Africans, but there's also pictures of Chinese migrants and Middle Easterners. And in this slideshow, I show some of the other pictures of different groups, not only Africans. But I think you see that there's a difference in how the Africans present themselves, where I think the Chinese tend to be much more stiff, and there's something much more playful and, I think, personal and intimate in many of these pictures.
Do you want to add something? Or?
I mean, we talked about so much. I can ask more things. I also didn't know if you wanted to open it up. It seems like there's such a great turnout of people. I'm sure they're dying to ask some questions. Or
maybe I just ask you one more question, and then we open it up. So can we stay with this question of ethics in a way? Like we had this discussion just before about all sorts of things. We talked about temporality in this archive and many other things, performativity. But we also talked about, like, for instance, that this is not about street photography, for instance. And so could you help us, like, situate what, I mean, you've just situated in relation to kind of maybe African or even Chinese vernacular photography. So how could we understand the ethics of this project? I know you've been talking about it, but for instance, I had said before, you know, in social documentary photography in the United States, you know, one doesn't seek permission.
Right.
So why is that such for you a problematic topic, the lack of, let's say, the lack of permission having been granted.
In the beginning, it wasn't such a big issue to me, to be totally honest. I mean, I guess at first I saw it as the Chinese photographers, I felt like they had the right to use these pictures because they're the photographers. Later on, I guess people kept asking me, well, did you have the permission from these people to use these pictures? So then I started to think more about it. Like, for one thing, they're not my photographs. So in a way, I'm taking the pictures of these two migrant photographers, and they, you know, they didn't ask these people whether they could use them for other purposes. So in a way, it's more. I think it's more the problem for me is, you know, it was their assumption that these pictures were being deleted, you know, not being used again. So I guess that's
their original kind of staging, they're meant to disseminate, right?
They were meant to disseminate to who they wanted to disseminate to. They weren't for the web, you know. They were, if they were for the web, they would have taken selfies. They were making, the reason they had these done was because they could be printed out. You know, they could hire these Chinese photographers and make a tangible print, which is something pretty anachronistic in these days. So really, they were quite private. You know, they were making these pictures to give to their family or to show to, you know, people, you know, loved ones or whoever. So in a way, it wasn't their intention to disseminate them. Even though that they look like they're in the public space and they're presenting themselves in a you know, with new clothing, and it looks like they're quite meant for the public. But I don't really know, like, what their intention was.
I mean, just to add to what you're both saying, I think there is a big difference between self-presentation and we were also talking about exotification before, right? So we were talking about how there's a history with colonial portraiture and colonial representations in general, where there's a level of exotification and things like that. But when you are involved and you're part of collaborating with the photographer and how you want to be staged, that you know, it's more fuzzy and not an example. I think what Aaron and I are arguing, that it's not necessarily problematic.
I'm not the photographer, so I'm not exoticizing. Yeah. I mean, in a sense, they're self-presentations. They're more like self-portraits.
We were talking about how in a really fascinating and almost strategic way, you kind of exempted yourself from the complex kind of politics of representation by shifting that project.
Where I'm culpable is how I've edited them. I guess, you know, I mean, the thing is, out of 30,000 pictures, in a way, I am photographing still by how I choose to edit the pictures, because I'm kind of choosing the pictures. I mean, there's so many different ways you could edit that in a way I am still kind of speaking. I am sort of representing my own point of view in it. And actually, it was really helpful to bring in another editor who could kind of see them in different ways. And I've showed you know, the work to many people. So actually, the way I've seen the pictures has evolved a lot. And for instance, you know, I was at first including some pictures that were more sensational and kind of, you know, maybe of prostitutes, and I since kind of took those off because I felt that they didn't really fit what the what I wanted the project to be.
One last quick question before I stop hogging the mic. So this collaboration that you have with your two fellow photographers, it seems, I mean, could you talk a bit more about it? Is it a social relationship? Is it purely like an a formal collaboration? Is it a personal?
Well, I'm on there's a Chinese social media site called WeChat, which is kind of like the Chinese version of Facebook. And I just texted one of the photographers some pictures of the exhibition, so I'm still in touch with them.
I mean, what seems to be unusual, or maybe particularly singular about this collaboration, is that you're also collaborating across class in a profound way.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I'm interested in how you've negotiated that, which is maybe a dimension that in the States we like kind of sometimes forget about. Collaboration seems easy. It's just what we do as artists. Right. But here there's very complicated things that are being negotiated, their precarity, economic and social, and so many other things.
Yeah. I mean, the guy in the first room was the first guy that I approached. And he was suspicious at first. Like he didn't know what I was up to, and you know, I had to really convince him that, you know, I thought what he was doing was important. And both of these guys are, you know, hand to mouth. You know, they make maybe, if they're lucky, a couple hundred dollars a month. So I think part of their motivation with working with me was in hopes that I would find a way to remunerate them. And but I think, you know, over time they've also, I mean, I went back maybe 10, 15 times to go and visit them. So they also, just by, you know, my insistence, they sort of realized that I was really serious and that I really thought that what they were doing was important. So I think they just, over that time, level of trust really developed. And I think they also came to see what they were doing and kind of how I saw it. They started to see it as that they were doing something important. So I think, you know, I don't know if we're friends exactly, but we, you know, I keep in touch with them and tell them what's happening with the project, and you know, and I'm, you know, we've come to care about each other, and I mean, I guess, what was I gonna say? I mean, in terms of money, you know, I never offered to pay for them. Like I sort of set it up as kind of that we're collaborators on making this project. But when I've published the work in a magazine, I split the proceeds with them, and whenever I can, I try to help them out. And then, in fact, they're both, neither photographer is working there anymore. They've both kind of had to stop photographing for different reasons. So in a way, it's a project that's already finished. Like this archive is closed.
Yeah. And I just wanted to add one more comment before to contextualize it further, is that the collaborative model of representing people is like a more new phenomenon in the history of visual anthropology and representation in general, in that it tends to be looked upon very favorably because for many decades, the way people went about it was a very top-down approach. So when you work with people who are very much embedded and very much part of the culture, and you know, it's a whole different experience, and that's like a newer model that's it's highly encouraged. Yeah. Mm-hmm.